Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with James McWilliams, whose new book is The Life and Poetry of Frank Stanford. Williams is a professor of history at Texas State University who divides his time between Austin and New Orleans. He's the author of The Modern Savage, Our Unthinking Decision to Eat Animals, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly, and many other books about food. But today we're talking about a new book, a marked change in his writing direction. It's called The Life and Poetry of Frank Stanford, and it is a completely absorbing literary biography of an Arkansas poet who developed a cult-like following not only during his lifetime, but after his suicide in 1978. It is a work of rare beauty and care, holding the reader close for all of its more than 500 pages. James McWilliams, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for having me.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
I see why this book took almost 8 years to write.
Yeah, it was an absorbing project.
So tell us about Frank Stanford.
Well, I actually got introduced to Frank's book, The Battlefield Where the Moon Says I Love You, way back in 2000, I think, when the second edition came out. And I fell in love with it and was unable at the time to afford, well, in not just at the time, I would say today too, to afford his chapbooks, which are super rare. So I just knew that poem. But when Copper Canyon put out his collected works in 2015, I read them. And all of his poems, and I really started to think seriously about pursuing him in some sort of scholarly way, and ended up, you know, deciding to do this biography.
One of the things that makes me fall in love with a book is the quality of a writer's obsession. This book has obsession writ large on every page, which I loved. And served me well as a reader. So talk about how your interest in him grew and sustained itself for such a long period of time.
Yeah, it's a complex word, obsession, because
it can,
you know, on the one hand, it can lean in an unhealthy direction, but on the other hand, it can lead to, I think, some remarkably creative work, and it certainly did for Frank. And I think in some ways, the obsession that I developed as I did this research was in part a reflection of the obsession that he brought to his work. He was remarkably single-minded when it came to writing poetry. He wrote for extended periods of time. He completely tuned the world out as he wrote. And the results of that were often socially quite disastrous, but creatively and poetically brilliant. Now, I didn't want this necessarily to happen to me in my life. I wanted my social life to stay relatively healthy, but I also really wanted to write something that reflected the energy and, to a certain extent, the obsessiveness of Frank and his poetry. I just felt like a biography should do more than just gather the facts and arrange them on an individual, but should in some ways reflect the character of that individual as well. One more thing I'd add to this, though, is I think what kept me balanced was I had to interview hundreds of people for this book, and many of them multiple times, and became close friends with many of the people that Frank knew. And that, to an extent, I think really kept my obsession with the writing and the research balanced out, because I could always come up for air and talk to these people about Frank. So it was, in some ways, a kind of a fortunate juxtaposition of solitary work and social engagement.
Now, I want you to read the first couple of pages, because I think they reflect that obsessive quality in all its glory.
I'm very happy to do that. Early morning, June 3rd, 1978, in Uptown New Orleans house at 519 Webster Street, Frank Stanford got out of bed, went into the bathroom, and wrote in black ink a message on the wall just above a tacked-up poster of Michelangelo's The Last Judgment. What is Frank looking for? He got dressed and took $10 in an old suitcase that belonged to his friend and fellow poet Ralph Adamo, in whose house he had just slept. After packing his clothes, Frank went to meet the writer Ellen Gilchrist for breakfast. They ate on Magazine Street, possibly at Tranchina's. "This is goodbye," Frank said to her after breakfast. "This is really goodbye." Then Kay DuVernay, a poet and photographer with whom Frank had spent the night, picked him up and drove him to the airport to fly home to Fayetteville, Arkansas. What was Frank looking for? Impossible question. Nobody will ever fully know. But on that morning, at least, he wanted an escape. Typically, escaping was something he did well. Frank escaped having to ask his friend Ralph for money. He escaped whatever expectations DuVernay, a woman whom Frank had known for many years, might have entertained about the poet she had loved through the night. But most notably, Stanford, by sojourning in New Orleans for over 2 weeks, had escaped facing in person the anger of his wife Jenny Crouch Stanford and his lover C.D. Wright, because the jig was up. A day or two after Frank left for his trip to New Orleans on May 18th, the two women had discovered that they'd been deceived by the handsome and charismatic poet. Frank had told Jenny that his relationship with C.D. was a working relationship, and he had told C.D. that his marriage with Jenny was one of convenience. But the facts were otherwise. He was in love with and sleeping with both women. And now these women were letting him know that they knew. They were also making it clear that he would suffer consequences. When C.D. and Jenny met at a mutual friend's house in Fayetteville to discuss the matter, they were, according to this friend, holding each other up for support, and they were really angry. Frank Stanford was not eager to head back home, whatever that word now meant to him, into a maelstrom of emotion. He must have known the discovery was going to happen. Jenny had evidently found love letters he'd written, presumably to write, in a file of his poems to which she had ready access. "It felt," Jenny later recalled, "like the end of the world." Almost 20 years later, Wright remembered Jenny's immediate response to her discovery of the evidence. "Within 2 hours, she was at my door." Frank had kept these two talented and intelligent women in the dark about each other, or at least about the nature of his relationship with them, for nearly 2.5 years. Jenny and C.D. bonded in their pain and desire for retribution. There was a lot of tenderness between them, recalls this friend whose kitchen they met in. "We talked for the next 2 weeks, and there was a lot of driving back and forth," Wright said about her meetings with Jenny, who was living in southern Missouri. As they waited for Stanford to return, the two women planned a reckoning. Once the legendary poet returned to Fayetteville, mustering whatever it took to come through the door at 705 Jackson Drive, he would face that which he had always had a complicated relationship: reality. So on this morning of June 3rd, 1978, standing in Ralph Adamo's bathroom, Stanford was in an unprecedented position. The poet was trapped. Reality, something he'd long eluded or at least kept at bay, now had him in a vice. No artifice, much less art, could free him. For perhaps the first time, Stanford finally knew the answer to the question he had written on the wall that morning. He may have even penned those words as his epitaph.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James McWilliams, whose new book is The Life and Poetry of Frank Stanford. This next section contains discussion of suicide, which may be distressing for some listeners. If you or someone you know is struggling or in crisis, please call or text 988 for support.
So you began this book with what I imagine was the most difficult part to write.
The most difficult part to write, certainly emotionally, and in some ways, I wanted to get every fact right. Because I think when it comes to something like Stanford's suicide, his myth has grown largely around that suicide. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways this is unfortunate because he lived such a remarkable full life. And for the vast majority of people who know about Frank Stanford to actually know him through his suicide, I mean, it seems very natural, but it also seems unfair given the fullness of his life. So my intention there was to tell the story as directly, as factually as I could right up front, because on some level, I think it's harder to mythologize an individual or an event if you actually have the hard facts right there. I mean, facts have a way of diffusing a myth to a certain extent. So, I mean, I think that was part of the intention. But then the other part of the intention was just to say, hey, look, like if you're reading this biography, you probably already know this about Frank. Let's just go ahead and get it out of the way. Yeah. And then we'll get down to the business of how he lived this really astonishing life.
But from the very beginning, his mother was an amazing character. You could do a whole book about her.
Yeah, I mean, this is true for so many aspects of this book. The events that defined his life seem to have almost just a built-in mystery or drama that, I mean, as a biographer, it's wonderful because I've gotten wonderful feedback on this book, and I'm really grateful for it. And a lot of work went into this book, but it would have been hard to screw this story up. It was so, there was
so much there.
There's so much there. There's so many details. His mother was this really incredible woman, complicated woman. I mean, her racial views were really quite distressing. On the other hand, she was the first single woman to adopt a child in the state of Mississippi. She was the first woman to run a Goodyear franchise in the organization's history. And she lived very well when, you know, they were well off when she married a wealthy levee engineer who was 30 years her senior. But when that levee engineer died, he left his estate to his first family. And Dorothy, the mother, and Frank and his sister fell into relative poverty. And she just went to work. I mean, she didn't skip a beat. There was a kind of resilience to her that was really quite remarkable. And in fact, Frank's publisher, Irv Broughton, who plays a major role in Frank's life and success as a writer, actually did sort of do some research towards writing a book about Dorothy. Oh, wow. I don't think he ever got around to doing it. But, you know, your instinct about her really needing her own book is, I think, right on the money.
Well, it was so interesting when Frank went off to go to Subiaco Academy to go to boarding school. This was, you know, the great thing she could arrange for him, and she goes to work there as well. And it made me think of The World According to Garp.
Yeah, you know? that's interesting with the whole family kind of around.
Yeah, the whole family at the boarding school.
Very involved in the boarding school. This was something that I think Frank was a little bit self-conscious because he showed up as a junior and all of his classmates had been there for several years. And he showed up as a junior and, you know, he shows up with his mother and his mother is working in the retreat center.
Yeah.
And there was this fear on Frank's part that he would be perceived or branded as this rich mama's boy. He quickly disabused anyone of that notion. He distinguished himself in a number of ways at Subiaco. More than anything else, he was encouraged and supported in his pursuit of poetry.
Yeah.
They had moved to Subiaco from Mountain Home, Arkansas. And Mountain Home, Arkansas is a wonderful place, but it wasn't the kind of place in the early 1960s where, you know, a 13 or 14 year old boy's obsession with poetry would get rewarded with, you know, like being cool. But when he got to Subiaco, the monks very much encouraged people to pursue their eccentric interests. And Frank, in some ways, was given this green light to just become the poet that he wanted to be. And his friends were calling him the poet laureate of Subiaco. He also distinguished himself by starting a judo club. Frank was deeply interested in, like, the Bushido warrior philosophy.
The poet of the warrior,
and he translated this into his love for judo, and he started a judo team that distinguished itself. It did really well, but he was the coach. He was the founder. He organized everything, and so he became known for both being this poet and this, like super strong and athletic judo guy. So it didn't take long for people to disassociate Frank from his mother, who he really did not interact with very much when he was there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James McWilliams, whose new book is The Life and Poetry of Frank Stanford.
Now, one of the other things that comes home again and again in this book is how wide-ranging Frank's talent was, that he had a passion for film and a passion for publishing.
Yeah.
And was extremely generous to other writers and was an autodidact.
Right. Again, this kind of goes back to what I was saying at the beginning about leading this remarkable life. I mean, he was an autodidact. I mean, he started to read Faulkner around the age of 10 or 11. Mm-hmm. And that led him into D.H. Lawrence, Eliot, Pound, Melville, all the way back into the 19th century. And then he started reading, you know, medieval French translated poems, and just this hugely omnivorous aesthetic interest that he just couldn't feed it fast enough. Mm-hmm. So really just devoured literature. But yeah, and then he got into French New Wave film and just decided he needed to make his own film and made a remarkable film with Irv Broughton that won, won an award at a West Coast poet, mm-hmm. or rather a West Coast film festival. He had opportunities to do more with film. He didn't pursue them, unfortunately. But I think he would have, had he lived, he would have become just a major filmmaker. Now, in terms of starting the press, it was a really interesting phase in his life. He had remarkable publishing success in the 70s, particularly with the little magazines. And, you know, these little magazines, poets would submit work to them and these magazines had about a 3-5% acceptance rate. And Frank had like closer to a 95-100% acceptance rate with these.
Incredible.
So he had an incredible run for about 5 years where he was publishing everywhere that he wanted to publish, highly prestigious literary magazines. And he was watching very good poets around him have very little success. Mm-hmm. And so he started this press in part, yes, to publish his own work, The Battlefield, but he also started this press to support the work of poets, again, the underdog poets, the overlooked poets.
The underdog poets. I love that
so
much.
And he really wanted to kind of put them on the map. And so you take somebody like Ralph Adamo, the New Orleans mm-hmm. poet Ralph Adamo, who published his first book because of Frank, you know.
Sadness at the Private University.
Yeah, it's a wonderful
great
book.
Title.
It's a great title. And Frank actually insisted on that title. Ralph might not want me to say this, but Ralph wanted a different title. And Frank said, "No, I've read these poems more than anybody except you, and we're going with my title." His commitment to these underdog poets was really fierce. And also the women that he dated, often simultaneously, but he was extremely supportive of his wife, Jenny, as a painter. And he really was a mentor to C.D. Wright in her early years as a mm-hmm. poet. People don't realize this, but C.D. Wright went to Arkansas as a law student. She started there in law school and decided that this wasn't for her and that she wanted to be a poet. And it's around that time that she met Frank, and Frank really, well, she read The Battlefield and was like blown away by it. And mm-hmm. She and Frank became romantically involved, but also Frank always was very supportive and encouraging of her poetry as mm-hmm. well.
Well, you know, when you undertake a project like this, you kind of move in with the person. You give them headspace for years and years and years.
Yeah.
You have to love them. So what is it about Frank that you found useful and instructive and inspiring for your life?
During the writing of the book, I would say that a night didn't pass where I didn't dream. Like, I don't want to say a nightmare, but the details of his life that I was trying to iron out entered my dreams. And that always was an indication to me that I'm very close to this mm-hmm. project. How close did I get to the person? I would like to say that I don't think it's possible to more accurately reconstruct his life and to probe the significant developments of his life. Mm-hmm. Maybe on that latter point, there's more probing to be done. But in terms of like actually assembling the details of his life, talking to the people that I needed to talk to understand him, this book, I think, reflects a great deal of work on that score.
Yes, it does.
But I can't honestly say that I feel close to Frank. I don't, but the thing is, I don't think anybody did. And this is something that I realized in the course of my research, and maybe this is an indication of how maybe I did get to know him well, is I realized that there was something so deeply private about Frank And I think his genius was so singular. And I realize this sounds romantic, but I think he really did have a vision that was so uniquely his that he never was able to really fully share it with anybody else, and therefore was never able to connect with anybody else, perhaps the way a part of him wanted to. He was always in his own world a little bit, or in many cases, a lot. What inspired me nonetheless? So I can't say that I became close with my subject in the sense that I understand him deeply as a human being. I left this book with a remarkable appreciation for an individual who was so committed to his art that he put his art actually ahead of his own life in some ways. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, obviously a problematic set of priorities, but nonetheless, at the same time, he loved living life as a poet. I mean, he loved being a poet. And I think his most intensely satisfying and happy moments were when he was writing the poetry that he knew he was capable of writing. So I do take like a great deal of pleasure in knowing that he took a great deal of pleasure in his own talent.
Mm-hmm. In many ways. I mean, there's one picture in this book of him that is, to me, the happiest picture. And he's standing in what looks like a garden with his arms full of maps when he's doing surveying.
Right. And that's a beautiful picture. It was taken by Jenny, his wife, Jenny, second wife, Jenny. And yeah, there is a kind of satisfaction there. And that was actually at a time in his life. And that was a bit rare. I mean, from late 1973 to late 1975, he and Jenny lived in almost a kind of bourgeois domesticated setting, you know.
Sounded heavenly.
Yeah, it did. And I think he worked very hard to settle into it. I mean, he was working a 9-to-5 job as a surveyor. He was writing his poetry at night. He was not drinking. He and Jenny would take long walks, you know, on country roads.
They had a garden.
They had cats. They cooked. And so I think in some ways what you're seeing in that beautiful photo is a sense of him having, in a sense, eased into that way of life, that very sort of much slower paced mm-hmm. way of life. But, you know, what you're not seeing there is the deeper dissatisfaction, mm-hmm. the need to live harder, to live faster, to take more risks, to put himself in danger, because I think that's where the poetry came from.
Sure.
Yeah.
Would you read the epigraph? I love the epigraph you chose for this book.
Yes. Nobody knows you. No. But I sing of you. For posterity, I sing of your profile and grace, of the signal maturity of your understanding, of your appetite for death and the taste of its mouth, of the sadness of your once valiant gaiety. Federico Garcia Lorca.
So that's what you set out to do, isn't it?
In a sense. And I found that Lorca quote very late in the game, and uh-huh. I couldn't believe it when I did, because it spoke so perfectly to Frank's life and in many ways what I was trying to do with it.
Mm-hmm. You did well.
Thank you.
this book is unputdownable. It really is.
Well, that's very gratifying to hear, because it is a very long book. And my obvious interest was to tell the life as fully and with as much detail as I could. But I am deeply immersed in this work. And sometimes when you're deeply immersed in something, you can't assume other people are going to join you on that journey.
Right.
And so it's been very gratifying to hear from readers who actually, in many cases, didn't even know Frank Stanford, that this is a page-turning experience. I don't know that the biography of Frank Stanford will ever be a beach read.
But, no, I don't think so. But
I wouldn't be disappointed if that happened.
But it's very satisfying to live in his world for a while. We've been talking with James McWilliams about his splendid new biography, The Life and Poetry of Frank Stanford. James, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan, so much for having me on.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Poet Chuck Perkins signs Beautiful and Ugly Too.
Friday, August 8th at 8 p.m. at Cafe Istanbul. Christy Maxwell and Jesse DeLong will read their poems in the Spliced Reading Series. Saturday, August 9th at 6 at the Saturn Bar. Colleen Dully discusses Struck Down, Not Destroyed, Keeping Faith as a Vatican Reporter with Loyola University Professor Lisa Collins, Tuesday, August 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Madeline Brauner Landry discusses and signs Caro Giovanni. That's at Author Night, Tuesday, August 12th at 6:30 at the Cedar Dennis Hubble Library. Co-authors Calvin Duncan and Sophie Cull discuss and sign their book, The Jailhouse Lawyer, Wednesday, August 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library sponsor a warehouse and puzzle sale from 9 to 4 Saturday, August 9th at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Patrick Gibson discusses podcasts for beginners and more at 9:30 a.m. Saturday, August 9th, followed by a one-hour flash nonfiction writing workshop with Anel Lopez. That's at 11 a.m. as part of the Saturday, August Writers Clinic at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Sessions are free of charge and open to the public, no registration.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.